Base Power is one of the coolest companies I've ever featured on First Principles, and they came out of stealth today. They are building huge home batteries, which are basically different than other batteries in two ways, one technical and one business. The technical reason is that it's huge. It's literally 30 kilowatt hours, which is more than double a Tesla Powerwall. Why does it need to be so big? Well, the answer is it's doing more than just home backup. It still can do that, of course. If the power goes out, you can draw power from your battery instead of directly from the grid. But it is also buying and selling electricity on the open market. So it's buying when it's low and selling when it's high. Now, you as a consumer don't necessarily see all that. You just get a home battery for effectively free just for the installation cost. But Base Power is actually building on the back of that a successful business. That is the second major difference, where they are a seller and buyer of electricity rather than just a hardware supplier. So this is an incredible company, and their founders are awesome. The one that we talked to in the episode is Justin Lopas, who is known for basically two things. First of all, for being the lead manufacturing engineer on SpaceX's Starship rocket. Pretty damn cool. And the second one is that he went from that to go to Anduril, basically the second most successful startup in recent times. So this is going to be an amazing episode. I know you're going to love it. Let's dive into how these massive batteries work on First Principles.
We're here to help support the energy grid, starting here in Texas, on Austin, where I'm based, and do that by putting a lot of distributed storage on the grid. So storage co-located with the power load at the edge of the grid, as opposed to centralized or at the generation source. And after that, ultimately build a modern power company, both generation and storage and consumption. The real reason we're here for this is more energy equals more human prosperity. There's a ton of studies out there. I think probably your viewers have seen it, maybe you're familiar with, Christian, but there's a direct correlation between GDP per capita and energy availability in a given country. There's many studies on this coming increase and already existing increase in renewables and volatility of supply, as well as a lot more consumption of energy from EVs and heat pumps, and sort of the end use of energy in the form of electricity, is really putting a lot of stress on the grid. There's a lot of smart people, a lot of money going into make power cheaper, easier, better, more of it. There's nuclear, there's better solar panels, there's wind, there's more efficient natural gas plants, et cetera. And there's a ton of people working on the consumption side. This is EVs and heat pumps and all this other stuff. There's not a lot of folks focused on the grid, which is the thing that connects those two. And our view is that that is where we need a lot of support for this energy transition that we're working on now. So that's what we're up to.
Hell yeah. And you guys are doing it by basically installing big batteries at people's houses. Like that's how you're getting started, right?
Yeah. So the start of the company and the first product is a residential energy storage system. And so maybe taking a quick step back here, like why sort of do this? And you know, why do we think batteries are the solution or one of the solutions that we need in order to fortify the grid? So if you look at the grid today, and let's spend a bunch of time digging into the grid in a second, but if you look at the grid today, it is quite underutilized if you look at just what it is built for and what it on average does. And now you're like, that's kind of weird. I hear about grid stress all the time. Like, it seems like it's not built for what we need. And the answer is that it is not built for what we need from a peak demand standpoint, but most of the time you're well below peak, right? In any given year, by definition, there's only 1 second or one 15 minute interval here in Texas, or 1 hour or 1 day that is peak. Everything else is below that. If you put energy storage on the grid and you co-locate that energy storage with the load, you're able to reduce the peak and therefore have more total load with the same system size. By putting the batteries at the load side as opposed to at the generation side, you also can time shift, not only can time shift demand, but you can time shift supply from renewables that are not always there, or you can turn them on like the wind and the sun. By putting big batteries at homes and businesses that are focused on the grid as opposed to just focused on kind of backing up solar panels and being sized for the solar panels in the home, you can in aggregate really increase the utilization of the existing grid infrastructure, as well as decrease those peak loads and support more renewable generation. If you look at renewable generation as a percentage of total fuel mix, what you'll find is that is going up a lot every year, both wind and solar. In particular, here in Texas, there's a lot of wind, and on California, there's a lot of solar. Without batteries, the marginal value of adding the next solar panel or adding the next wind turbine on the grid goes down, because you have this negative pricing when everybody else is producing. But all the sun's up is the only time you can produce with a battery, or sorry, with that you can produce with a solar panel. And so you need a battery to sort of soak up all that extra production and therefore incentivize more and more renewable generation.
Yeah, I mean, people don't really understand this, but most electrons that are captured by like solar panels or what have you are used like the speed of light later, basically. Like from the time it takes, it's captured by the solar panel, travels at the speed of light to my house, and then I'm immediately using it in my like blender or whatever. Like the if it's not used, there are actually pieces of the grid where you're, or there's like policies or whatever where you have to pay for generating electricity. Like that's what you said with the negative thing. It's like curtailments. Like you want to talk a little bit about what that is and how that like real-time supply and demand thing works?
So I'm a mechanical engineer by background, so I think about everything in terms of physical sort of realities. I think that's kind of helpful for folk. Imagine electricity is just water for a second. Like if you had to generate, if you had to produce the water or pump the water out of ground or however you produced it, and you had to drink the water or use it for bathing or whatever, the basically the exact same time, and you couldn't store any of it anywhere, that would be pretty hard. You need to make sure that you're pumping the exact right amount of water at all times for the use, which is changing. Some, you know, people take a shower at 8 a.m. and not 12 p.m., you know, 12 p.m. or 12 a.m., right?
Yeah.
And so if you think about it from that perspective, storage is extremely critical for the stability of the grid writ large. And so it is exactly as you said, energy is created in the same instant it is consumed, unless you have storage, which allows you to time shift that supply or that demand. You can think about the grid almost like a network, kind of like visualizing a network of pipes under a city or something with water. It's the same sort of concept, and you have the same concept that you have in a pipe network, or you have in a network of roads where you have congestion. It's literally called congestion, like it is on roads, on certain lines of the grid. And so if you have a bunch of power on one side of Texas and a bunch of people on the other side of Texas, by the way, this happens. There's a lot of sun on the western part of the state, and there turns out Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Waco, Austin, they're all on the east part of the state. You have congestion to drive on the road from the solar farm, you know, in Midland to where all the people are in Austin, as an example. You got to kind of think about what the batteries do from both time-shifting demand as well as time-shifting supply, such that that road is fully utilized but not overutilized.
So the network analogy is a good one. And if you look at those maps of like, you know, the energy grid across America, it's funny. I think people don't really know this, but there are three grids in the United States. There is the East, the West, and Texas. Texas is its own thing, or ERCOT. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about what makes them so different and why? Like, you know, they really are very different from like a normal grid. For lots of reasons, and that's probably why you're starting.
Yeah, totally. So why are we starting in Texas? It's certainly not the only place that we will operate, but it's a really, really interesting place to begin. So you're totally right. There are three physical grid connections. There's the Western Interconnection, kind of like west of the Rockies. There's east and there's Texas, right? Texas is also colloquially known as the ERCOT region. This is the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, ERCOT. That is the another acronym for you, the ISO, the Independent System Operator, basically the kind of command center for the grid, so to speak. There's a handful of these ISOs. They also call them RTOs, regional transmission operators, which you'll find, by the way, it's totally aside here, maybe distracting, but I think there are more acronyms in grid and electricity than there are in the DOD and defense space, but
whoa,
that's a total aside.
That is a hot take. Even I thought you were even going to say space. So DOD definitely beats out space, but like just barely. And then wow. Okay. All right.
It's incredible. We have an acronym demystifier here at the
good
company.
Yeah.
For new folks. Anyways, total aside. so there's these ISOs and RTOs, one of which is called ERCOT, that operates the Texas grid. Texas is by and large totally disconnected from the other grids, and so the grid is all of, or pretty much all of the transmission is AC. It's alternating current, right? And so the frequency and the phase, or sorry, I should say just the phase of ERCOT's grid does not match the west or the east. And so any time that there is a tie between the west and the east to Texas, there's a DC link. Just to give you a sense, there's like less than 2 or 3% of the peak demand of Texas is linked to east and west. So it's effectively an island.
Yeah.
You can think about Texas's grid sort of like Hawaii's or Japan's, where it's like basically a functional island. The other interesting thing about Texas is it is the one place in the U.S. where the Sun Belt and the Wind Corridor meet, right? So the Wind Corridor is kind of like center U.S., east of the Rockies, west of the Mississippi, kind of that region. And the Sun Belt is obviously kind of the southern one to two states, right? And Texas is the only place that those two things meet up. And so there's a ton of renewable resource here. It's a common misnomer when people outside of Texas, myself previously included, think about Texas. They're like, oh, it's oil country. It is. There's a ton of oil and natural gas in the ground here. But there's more renewable resource here than anywhere else in the U.S. There's also an enormous amount of land to capture that renewable resource, both wind and solar. And so it's just a really interesting place. So renewable generation drives a lot of volatility of supply. The fact that Texas can't like borrow from its neighbors when it needs to drives also volatility of prices. And there's also what's called a deregulated energy market, which I'm sure we'll get into a ton of here later, that allows us to basically sell energy directly to consumers and essentially sort of be the energy provider to the customer. That's a unique thing here that happens in Texas and a handful of states, most of which are in the Northeast. But all of those things combined, it's a great place to, and the fact that it's a great place to be, Austin in particular, is why we started here in Texas.
Today's episode is brought to you by Coda. Teams use Coda to get on the same page literally. By bringing together documents and spreadsheets and apps all into one place, it stops you from ping-ponging all over all these different apps. Coda is great for working with remote employees or for just centralizing all that shared knowledge that is dispersed across your team. And now is the perfect time to get started with Coda with all of its extensive planning capabilities. With Coda, you can stay aligned by managing all of your planning cycles in one location. You can set and measure OKRs with full visibility across teams, and you can communicate and collaborate on documents and spreadsheets and roadmaps and other things like that. Coda also has this great gallery feature in which you can find tons of templates, literally hundreds of them, for any sort of document that you might need. If you want a platform that allows your team to collaborate effectively and focus on shared goals, you can get started with Coda today for free. Head over to coda.io/FP. That's coda.io/FP. Get started for free. That's coda.io/FP.
So I've heard people sort of like honestly mock ERCOT. It's just like the reliability piece and the word in particular, because there's the very famous example of that winter storm in like 2021 or whatever it was, when basically Texas being disconnected from the other grids couldn't get any energy into the state. And some people were just without power for a really long time.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of example is a great reason why you would want batteries, why you would want storage. But maybe that's a good example. Maybe that's like a good enough tie to like talk a little bit about those energy markets and tell us how the buying and selling works. And, basically just like what that looks like tangibly for like a consumer or a business in Texas.
Yeah. So let's start with how the Texas energy market works. So the sort of simplified view of this is there's essentially three main players. You've got the people who make the power, called the generators. You got the people who own the poles and the wires. This is like the grid itself. When you see poles and wires, like you think the grid, those are called the utilities. And then there are energy retailers. And those are the people that buy the energy from the generators, pay the poles and wires guys to deliver it, and they sell it to the end consumer. So if you're a homeowner in Houston or Dallas or Waco or Round Rock or whatever, you can choose who your power provider is. So this is very different than if you live in SoCal, where I used to live. And if you want electricity at your house, SoCal Edison is the only one you get.
That's right.
The only option. In Houston, you have like 100 plus different options of who you buy your power from. And those are called REPs, retail electric providers. We are a retail electric provider that buys energy from the grid on the wholesale markets and sells it at a retail rate to our customers. And so that is sort of one piece of the business, and that is tied in the batteries, and I'll get to that in a second. But the way to think about the Texas energy market is that you have freedom to choose who your power provider is as a consumer. Utilities themselves are regulated monopolies in their jurisdictions. So there's a handful of big utilities in the state. There's one as an example in Houston called CenterPoint. CenterPoint owns the poles and wires and the infrastructure, but they don't sell the energy to the customers, and they don't, and they can't legally generate the energy. So that's kind of like the three main buckets of how the Texas energy market works. The Texas energy market is also a relatively free trading market, meaning the price of energy changes every 15 minutes, 24/7, 365. If you go to ERCOT.com, you can see it's actually, they have some really good data on this. And the prices change based on supply and demand, just like any other market. But they also change geographically. So we can go into a lot of detail here. So I'll kind of like pull out of the rabbit hole for a second, but there is a handful of different ways in which it is broken up geographically. The important point here is that the prices at specific areas of the grid are different. And those prices are basically reflecting what I was saying earlier, which is congestion. So if there's a bunch of congestion on a line going from outside of the city of Houston into Houston, it is likely that the node on the city side of that is paying a high price, right, for that electricity. But over in Midland, as an example, where I spent the summer as an intern many, many, many years ago, in the oil fields out there, they might have negative pricing because there's more energy there than can be delivered across the transmission line all the way to Houston. What you'll find is that there's a large disparity in prices geographically based on where the energy is produced versus consumed and where there is congestion on the grid. And so that's that price signal tells us where we should go put a battery because that is where the most volatility is. And as you put a battery on in a specific node, you drive down the volatility by decreasing the peak demand and increasing the trough demand and sort of relieve that congestion. So kind of long-winded way of explaining how the Texas energy market works, but it's a fascinating, extremely, extremely niche and nuanced thing that like not everyone, especially those who don't live in Texas, but even those who do, aren't necessarily exposed to in their day-to-day. And that's a really fascinating thing to learn about, which is why I'm so excited to learn about it.
Totally. I mean, I think the so when you are a seller, because you can be both, right? You don't have to be both just a buyer. You can also be a seller, which is kind of part of the point. You can buy it when it's low and sell it when it's high. So do you sell it back to the utilities or do you sell it to other reps?
So here's the analogy that I use that I think is helpful. So imagine that you and I are standing on either end of like a lake and we each have cups and like I have a cup of water. Yours is empty. I pour my water into the lake and then you like pick your cup up into the lake. It's like you didn't get my water. Like you just got water, but it's like sort of contributed by me, right?
Okay, yeah.
That's sort of the way to think about it from a physical perspective. There's a bunch of different sort of sub-markets, but let's just say you're in what's called the real-time market. Exactly what it sounds like. I buy energy right now. I pay the price, like this 15-minute interval price for the energy to either charge my battery or run my blender, like you said. That's on the buying side. On the selling side, when you're selling back to the grid, you're essentially offering it almost like you're offering a stock to the New York Stock Exchange or you're pouring a cup of water into the lake. It's like a, you know, sort of bid-ask spread, so to speak. And,
sure.
And kind of that's how you're paid back. The utilities are very impartial to the market. So they basically are the... They just transmit the energy from where it is generated to where it is consumed.
How much of a spread are we talking about, though? Like, if it can be literally negative in wherever, Midland, and then positive, presumably still in Austin, like that's obviously a huge spread. But like a normal day or whatever, it's not. I imagine it's not huge spreads. Like, is the market like relatively efficient across geographies, or is it actually like pretty large spreads that you would see throughout a normal day?
So there's spreads across geography, and then there's also spreads across time. And so the market is efficient, but the pricing volatility is very high. So I would encourage you or maybe viewers to actually spend some time on the ERCOT website. It's really just like if you're a nerd on this stuff like I am, you think you'll find it quite fascinating. But basically, if you look at kind of just, let's abstract away the geographic volatility for a second and just look at sort of average prices in the whole state. As the sun is setting, you have this like pretty common problem, especially in the summertime. The sun is setting, so supply is falling, available supply is falling, but demand is just peaking because this is like as people come home from work. This is not the demand peaking at like 5, 6 p.m. is not a Texas phenomenon. That happens kind of everywhere. But you have demand peaking just as supply is falling. And so you have this like approaching curves that happen and unfortunately get quite close to each other in the summer. This is what batteries help support. And you'll have prices that can go from zero or negative in the middle of the day when you have overproduction, from solar and wind, up to, and I just put a number in your head here, is up to $5,000 per megawatt hour. That's $5 per kilowatt hour. Just to give you a sense, like in in the very, very expensive utilities, like in California, you're paying on the order of like 30 or 40 or 50 cents a kilowatt hour. You're not paying you're not paying nearly this sort of $5. So there's this very, very volatile prices that especially happen in the summer when you have declining supply from solar and wind, and you have peaking demand, especially from HVAC loads. So the spreads are quite high, and they are highest in the areas in which they sort of need batteries the most. And so the way to think about it is what we're doing with a battery on a customer's home is when energy is very expensive, we're discharging it. Yes, we are selling it back to the grid, but we're also negating the load of the home. So if you come home at 5 p.m. and energy prices are $5 a kilowatt hour, $5,000 a megawatt hour, we are likely discharging the battery into the home, and the rest is going to the grid in order to basically say, okay, we don't need to go buy that at very expensive energy from the grid to sell to you at what would normally be a loss for any other rep that doesn't have a battery. And so it certainly makes you know, our economics as a business better, but very importantly, it allows us to offer very competitive rates to customers. And by the way, they get the benefit of the backup. We haven't talked about that. We totally need to spend some time on that.
Totally.
But the fact that we're able to basically turn off the customer from the grid at certain expensive times means that our average cost to serve that customer is decently less than it would be if we were just a regular rep without a battery.
On the price spread between like the wholesale electricity price and the retail electricity price, like presumably this is a commodity market and people are just like racing to the bottom on that cost. Like there's not a huge amount of margin between like what you're buying and what you're selling it at as a rep. But I'm curious about that. I don't know if that's actually true. Like do you have enough of a margin to play with there basically between how you're buying it from the transmission dudes or like the utilities and then what you're selling it to consumers at?
Yeah, so you're basically asking what are the economics for just a standard rep? Yeah, I should be clear. We are a rep as a way to distribute our batteries. We think this is the most effective way to get the most batteries on the grid as possible. It allows us to offer a service to customers, and in particular allows us to monetize the value of a battery behind the meter that we own, right? It's very, very important for folks to understand. We're not like selling a battery to a customer. We are giving a battery to a customer. They're paying for install. We're giving them the battery. We retain ownership of it. It's much lower upfront cost to them. And the rep allows us to monetize that. Like if I gave you a battery and you live in PG&E territory or something, it would benefit you, but we wouldn't see any of that. And so we need to sort of see split the benefit in order to sort of give you the battery at no cost other than the cost of install to you. The rep is like not meant, it's not necessarily our core business. It is the way in which we go to market, but we're not here to be to be a rep that is like just for rep's sake. We're using the rep as a wedge into the market in order to distribute batteries in a way that does not require us to kind of like, you know, have a huge deal with a big monolith utility. So to answer the question, being a rep on its own without the battery is a pretty tough business. You're right. It's a commodity business, and so you're looking for ways in which you can lower your average buy price because you have a flat fixed sell price. Typically, is how most reps price their energy. There's a lot of like really interesting, probably not for the subject of this conversation, but really interesting data analysis and trading and risk pieces that come with being a rep. But our core business is really building a battery farm,
totally,
and bringing customers along for the journey in the energy transition. And by the way, we use a rep to distribute it.
I think the interesting thing about how most home batteries are deployed today is that you see them almost always alongside solar. Like what does everybody think when they think of a home battery? They think of a Tesla Powerwall. Like what do people have their Tesla Powerwall attached to? The solar panels that are on the roof. Like most people think of it as a thing I am buying a battery to go along with my solar panels. That's like the normal way. And that's why I think that your rep thing is so interesting, because you're basically giving people batteries. All they have to do is pay for the cost of installing the original service, but otherwise it's free. And then they just like have the benefit of a battery, but they didn't have to buy it, and they don't even have to have solar on the roof. Like, that's a pretty unique model. And I would love for you to dive into like why you chose that and the benefits of that and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I think you hit on the exact right core kind of question here and core sort of differentiator, Christian, is that it's a completely different business model than your sort of traditional battery developer manufacturer. Our thesis and philosophy and what we're seeing so far, and if you look kind of out in the market today, is that the battery does not really provide a lot of benefit to the home. It provides the benefit of backup, which is by the way very 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 important, especially to folks here in Texas where unfortunately there's a lot of outages. But that benefit is only happens like a handful of times a year. Even in Texas where it happens a lot, it's like once a month, once every other month kind of thing. But the rest of the time, that thing is just sort of sitting there, not providing value to the home. It should be providing value to the grid. Also, the battery is much more valuable to the power company, or I should say, the battery is much more valuable to whoever is exposed to the wholesale markets where the real volatility is, as opposed to just a flat rate. Like if you bought a battery from whoever, and you put it in your home, and you paid 15 cents a kilowatt hour all the time, like why do you care about time shifting?
Yeah, exactly.
Energy, right. The value of the battery is really best for the grid and best exposed to the wholesale markets, and so that's what the REP allows us to do. And so, yeah, this is like a core fundamental piece of the puzzle is you get the benefits of home backup without the high upfront cost, and all the rest of the time the benefits accrue to the grid, which then lowers system costs and ultimately lowers cost of energy. More available energy, more human prosperity, like we sort of started the conversation with.
Hell yeah. That's perfect. I mean, I think that there's so many interesting choices that you guys made with the battery deployment too. So there's like, we can talk about all of them, but there's like load side versus generation side. There's like the size of the battery. There's the chemistry of the battery. There's, I don't know. It's like the business model, which we already sort of talked about, the inverter that goes along with the battery. Like all these things are really, really fascinating to me. So let's just like talk about all of them. I think maybe the simplest place to start is the size of the battery. Like that's a very unique thing for you guys. Do you want to tell us why you chose the size you did and what it is?
The battery that we're developing now is a 30 kilowatt hour system. And so that that is far larger than your traditional home battery systems, which are on the order of 10 plus or minus kind of 5 kilowatt hours. The reason for that is a fewfold. One, I would say the reason that the existing home batteries in the market today are relatively small is because they're sized to be paired with solar, right? So like one battery is roughly on average one solar system on a house worth over a day. So you basically, produce over the day, you store in the battery, and then you discharge, for a handful of hours at night. And again, that battery is just sort of like focused on the home. When you go, okay, that home is really a way for us to get interconnection onto the grid. And by the way, we're already there. The truck's there. The electrician's already there with the tools. Let's put as much energy as we can because the customer is not like directly paying for it, right? The cost basically scales, roughly linearly with dollar per kilowatt hour. And so we're like, hey, we might as well just put as much battery on there as we reasonably can that can reasonably fit. And so the bigger the battery, generally the better. Obviously, there's like space and electrical panel limitations we can talk about and sort of like where the real world meets like what is optimal. But the bigger the battery, generally the better. The other thing that we sized for is a pretty large inverter. And so the larger inverter allows us to discharge that battery, if we want to, all onto the grid or onto the grid in the home relatively quickly. What tends to happen, especially for pricing here in Texas, even in the summer and in the winter, is you get these really kind of peaky prices where it's not like a slow ramp up. It's like really high for maybe an hour, and then it's like low because now people are going to bed. It's like people came home from work and the sunset and gas plants have been turned back on or there's not enough batteries in the system, whatever. So prices are really high because supply was tight, and now price fell down because everybody's going to bed. And so you want to be able to discharge a lot of energy very quickly out onto the grid. And so the whole system we're developing is sized for how do we maximize the value of the interconnection at the home. The homeowner didn't know that their interconnection had value. Now they do. And the value that they get is having backup.
Can you talk about what that means, like, physically? So, like, I this is one of those things that I've only ever read and I've never actually said aloud before. So here we go. Like, the C rate or whatever, like, the basically, like, the way that a battery discharges, is it called C rate? I don't even know.
Totally. So, yeah, C rate is, you can think about it basically as 1 over the number of hours that it takes to discharge a given, like, sort of unit of battery. So a 1C battery is, like, from full to empty in an hour. Is the kind of way to think about it. People make it
seem more complicated than it's not that complicated.
So a 0.5C battery is a two hour discharge battery, essentially. We are using lithium iron phosphate cell chemistry, which is far more stable than the traditional nickel manganese cobalt or NMC, NCM chemistry that you'll find in a lot of EVs. Some EVs are switching over to LFP, but which you'll find there. And so it's much safer, it's much more stable. It's a little less energy dense than NMC, but you know, the thing isn't needing to accelerate 0 to 60 like my Tesla does. It's just sort of sitting there, and so the energy density isn't quite as important. And it's also lower cost. And importantly, it is it has way less sort of rare earth minerals than NMC does. You don't have the cobalt and the nickel and the manganese as the name would imply. And so our batteries are just about 1C, which allows us to discharge them roughly in an hour. So we have a 24-kilowatt inverter, 30-kilowatt-hour battery. You kind of asked sort of how you think about this physically. What folks will, you know, we'll see and we're bringing to market later this year. The battery is like, you can kind of imagine it's like an old or like an outdoor AC unit, kind of like on the order of 2-ish foot square by on the order of 3-4 foot tall. It's ground mounted. And so, much easier and simpler to install than a wall-mounted system. You don't have to worry about a lot of weight on the wall and doing structural calculations and all this other stuff. You need 4 square feet of available space, and you need some panel space to electrically wire it in, and there it is on the home. Would love to spend more time on kind of the whole deployment motion and operations, because that gets interesting as well.
Totally. I was actually, let's just head there right now. I mean, I think it's really interesting to ask or like to think about how you reduce the time and also the cost of deployment, because both of those probably matter a lot. I mean, the things that are probably in the time category are like even permitting. Like I imagine you do have to get this like permitted, right?
Yeah, yeah. So this whole, let me take a quick step back out from permitting for a second, because that's a rabbit hole we could spend an entire video on. I write a dissertation on permits at this point. We think about this entire thing, and this is kind of ties into my background here. We think about this whole thing from customer says they're interested in getting battery on their home and only paying for the cost of install and all the sort of benefits we discussed. From that, all the way through to operating battery on their home, and everybody's happy and we're discharging out on the grid. That whole thing we call the deployment factory. It's not necessarily like physically building a thing like in my past in kind of one location, but instead it is a series of process steps, each that have a cycle time associated with them, a number of humans that are required or automation that is required. They have tooling required for each one. And so this is a really, I think, like, honestly, decently differentiated thing from what many kind of in the like home services type business where it's sort of this vertical where our business lives does, or in solar install business. They typically think about each installation as like its own construction project, but the project manager, and it has like a unique set of permit plans and all of that stuff. We take a much different approach, which is, hey, we're installing a what is relatively simple in comparison to solar or any other thing that you would, you know, a hot tub or something or whatever, you know, a new kitchen you would install. This is like quite simple, both physically and electrically. We want to do it the exact same every time if we can. We want to offer the same product every time if we can, and we want to do it really fast. And so each step of that process, one or a handful of which are permitting related, has an owner. It has a sort of a defined entry to that process, a defined exit. These are all sort of first principles of manufacturing that we're applying to this motion. And so on the physical install time side, which is kind of what you're getting at, our system is far easier to install than what you'll traditionally see in the market. The ground mounting is a good bit of that. And then it also is like things that maybe sound simple but are very important. So like, instead of having multiple boxes either on the ground or on the wall sort of wired to each other, which requires conduit and conductors, and you have to strip and crimp and put fittings on the end of conductors, all of that is simplified by we sort of Lego brick stack our entire system. So we have a little sheet metal base, we have 6 battery modules, we put a battery management system on top of that, an inverter on top of that, and a hub on top of that. No tools are required for anything I just said. It's all board-to-board connections, it is latches, and it's all put together. And so the physical install, we think about like a NASCAR pit stop or like a factory line as opposed to something that you have to have a ton of experience and knowledge and skill set and sort of fine crafting and bending conduit exactly the right way and all this other stuff to connect a bunch of boxes together. So all of that comes in together when we go do the physical install, but there's a ton of work ahead of that, which is in relation to permitting and all that other stuff.
You mentioned the inverter, but is there other like ways that you have to plug into either the grid side or the house side that require more work than just like plugging stuff in?
Yeah, I mean, in the last segment there, I made it sound like it's literally just like plug in. So the mechanical side is quite easy to install. The electrical side is we build the whole system, and then we have one in and one out is the way to think about it. So because our system is quite large from a energy and power standpoint, we can use it to go right in between basically the meter and the main panel. Looking around the side of homes, you'll find there's typically a meter box, and at least here in Texas, that's almost always separate from the main breaker box. And so we basically intercept the line in between those two. We run out from the meter into our system, out from our system into the main panel, and that allows you to back up the whole home, as well as be able to backfeed onto the grid or discharge into the home. And so that does require a little bit of conduit, but it is not wiring our system to itself, so to speak. It is wiring our system into the home. And we're doing a number of things on the install side that relates to connectors and fittings and that sort of thing to make that process even as simple as possible. And there's some Skunkworks projects to make that even more easy, but I'll withhold details on those.
As a production guy, like a guy who has built factories and like built high throughput processes, basically, I'm sure that the way you think about this is like, what is my limiting step? Like, what are the things that can slow us down? What are the things that have the highest variability? Where are the places in the supply chain that, you know, I have to really like care about getting those parts in on time? So like maybe we'll buy more of them. Like, can you just tell us like how your production brain is approaching this like kind of different problem than building a bunch of rockets or a bunch of, you know, like weapon systems or whatever?
You know, I think it's like, I think that you can apply sort of this like production mindset to a lot of, you know, call it business processes. And so I think you're totally right. Like, one of the things we talk about a lot here is sort of the theory of constraints, like where's the blocker, and making sure that the constraint is obvious, easy to spot, well understood, and there are metrics around exactly what the right constraint is so that you can go put the right resources into that constraint and sort of squash that constraint very quickly to go on to the next one. So I think it's a really important principle of kind of how we're building out the operations here. Some of those steps are in our control. So as it relates to making sure that we have the right size system on the home and that we have the labor scheduled as an example, and that we have the right tools, and that we've communicated correctly with the customer. All those things are like in our control. Some of the items that are less in our control are on permitting or sort of interconnection with the utility, that sort of thing. And even then, like, you can apply a sort of production mindset, to use your terminology, to that, which is, okay, what are the steps that we need to take in order to provide the most accurate, clean submission we possibly can to the authority, whoever it is, they call AHJ, another three-letter acronym, authority having jurisdiction, which is like the municipality.
Authority having, that's funny.
Yeah, AHJ is like city of Austin or whatever, right? Like, that's the AHJ. And so we've spent quite a bit of time, we continue to spend time on each sort of new area we move into as a business, putting a lot of thought and effort and time into producing the exact right detailed documentation and submission such that the throughput or the fallout rate, if you're using in the manufacturing terminology, through that permit process is as throughput is as high as possible or fallout's as low as possible, right? So even things that are out of our control necessarily, we can still apply a production mindset to, and I think I'll get good results.
This might not be a thing that is kind of continuous. I guess it is to some extent, whatever. In the beginning of starting this company, you had to make a bunch of decisions about what are we actually going to build? What are we going to rely on partners for? What are we going to do? What are we going to do in house? What are we going to like source? Whatever. Like, build versus buy. You had to make a million of those decisions. Like, how did you end up making the ones you did? And actually, like, what are you building within the battery module itself?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So
Yeah, I think like what we're building here is a what we call a complex coordination, you know, machine. We have to be good at a lot of different things. All of the stuff that we just mentioned on the deployment factory, that's only one piece of it, though. We need to be good at financing and trading energy with ERCOT and all the regulatory sort of like, you know, hoop jumping you have to do there. We have to be good at acquiring customers and building a brand. We need to be good at software and hardware. And so what we've tried to do is be really thoughtful around build versus buy in sort of each one of those verticals. And so like as an example, on the installation side, we own internally, we own basically all of the pre-install, and then we subcontract out our electrician work today. This is something that we're kind of, you know, going, we will edit over time for sure, and have probably likely have a mixture of in-house versus out-of-house. We've said, hey, look, I think it's actually most beneficial for us to not manage the physical electrician labor today. So that was a build versus buy decision. So we need to be good at a lot of different things that are honestly quite different from each other. This is, by the way, total aside, but one of the interesting things about being a founder is that you do a lot of like context switching, especially in this business. We're going from hardware development to software development. That's like sort of engineering or technology. Then we've got customer acquisition and building a brand. This is more of a consumer products thing. We then go to energy trading and interfacing with the electricity markets. This is like more of a finance-ish thing, right? And so each one of those verticals, we have tried to be thoughtful on what we build versus what we buy. And so a good example of this is in the deployment factory that we talked about earlier. Again, deployment factory being customer says I want it to, it is installed on their home. In that, we are basically building, we're owning ourselves basically the entire pre-install process, and then we're working with a subcontracted electrician to basically do the physical install. And that was a conscious decision around build versus buy that we thought made the most sense at the time and continue to feel like it makes the most sense, but we'll likely change that over time. I think it's important, you know, a lot of businesses, especially those in sort of the ex-Elon company circles, perhaps, have a tendency to kind of really, really vertically integrate. And while I think like that's the ultimate end game that you should really be striving for, because if you're able to own pieces of the supply chain and the labor and the deployment factory and all that other stuff, it is very beneficial. It's not necessarily the place to start. And so we're trying to be very thoughtful about build versus buy and really build the things where we think we have some differentiated motion or process or technology, and buy the things where we don't have a differentiated thing today, and we'll add some differentiation over time.
I'm curious to hear also about, like, there's obviously a ton of decisions that you have to make when building basically battery packs about what to build versus buy. Can you talk us through a little bit more of those decisions about, you know, okay, you're not out there like mining the raw materials, but at the end of the day, you are building like presumably like the pack design or something that, you know, like how you integrate all the cells together, that kind of thing. Like where in that spectrum did you decide to draw the line and why?
At the cell level, it has made the most sense to buy. And I think what you'll find if you look at the battery market in general is that the automakers and stationary energy storage manufacturers are producing an enormous amount of cells at really low costs and really high quality. And so that's like and there are many companies out there that are working on this. We're not building a cell chemistry company, right? That's not kind of what we set out to go do. There are a handful of really fascinating companies that are working on that problem, but it's not something that we set out to go do. On the other end of sort of the hierarchy or the bill of materials, as it were, is the sort of enclosure and how we mount it to the other boxes around it and how we wire it and that sort of thing. That's like core to our custom hardware, and so that's really important for us to develop ourselves. So then there's like a spectrum in between, right? So connectors and individual electronic components doesn't make sense for us to do, but the integration of all of those pieces is really important. And I think what you'll find in a lot of kind of very successful integrator type businesses, and Anduril is certainly one of them, as we discussed, like
they're able to take existing technology that is maybe applied in a little bit of a different way or has a little bit of a different sort of look and feel or integration, and apply it to this new problem. And that's what we're doing kind of throughout the bill of materials. And so there's things in there that that are, while the component part is sourced by us, the integration and the overall construction of it is developed by us.
Totally. I mean, I think one of the other interesting things about y'all is that you are deciding to do a thing that other reps are not, that you're actually going to do this unique, this like modern software stack, basically, that, you know, looks good and is transparent to the customer and whatever, just like is a modern, nice software product. So do you mind telling us more about like both the consumer facing part of the software, but then also the other stuff like the, you know, trading and all that sort of thing?
Yeah. So we kind of think about kind of the software and maybe three areas kind of helpful to break it out. So there's the stuff that runs on the device. There's the stuff that runs in the cloud to manage the devices. And then there's the sort of consumer facing end of it. And you're right that, the kind of standard in the market today for retail electric providers is typically that they're not technology focused companies, right? Our view is that we should apply what is, you know, to some degree maybe table stakes for modern SaaS. If you're using some sort of B2B software in your day to day, the sort of Slacks or Ramps of the world, it's like good design, good UI, like high functionality, good integration. These things don't really exist today in the, you know, in the energy markets. If you've paid your bill for the electricity from a rep in Texas or anyone else, I think you'll probably agree, or any other sort of like utility service. And so we're developing a modern like good UI, so you can track your usage. There's a bunch of interesting features that we're going to be rolling out here over the next few months for consumers on the consumer end. Now the other two pieces, which is the software that runs on the devices and the software that runs on the network, is a really interesting problem, actually. So we like to think about it as sort of a distributed systems problem where you have a bunch of different things that you can't talk to. It's kind of like satellites in some way. It's like,
yeah,
like once you've deployed a battery and you have, you know, a lot of them out there, you definitely don't want to go back to them. It's sort of like a satellite in that way. It's sort of like, it's, you know, it's gone, it's out there. So you better be able to talk to it reliably. You better be able to get telemetry off of it reliably. You better know what it's doing and be able to diagnose and repair things all remotely without touching it. And so that's the sort of software stack that we're building, is the ability to manage the network very effectively and have the device do self-diagnostics and safety health checks and all that other stuff sort of on the device itself. And so that's the on-device software. And then the call it like higher-end sort of cloud-side software is both interfacing with the market. So it's, hey, the prices are high now here, and so I'm going to tell this battery or these few batteries to discharge, but actually they're low over there, so I'm actually going to tell those guys to charge. And so that management layer is a very complex sort of software problem. And also interfacing directly with the markets is also its own sort of, has some regulatory oversight around kind of how you do it and what trades you can place. And There's a handful of different markets. There's the real-time market. There's the day-ahead market. There's this thing called ancillary services. And so basically managing all of that is what we're developing the sort of top-level software to do.
Cool. Are you guys going to eventually have basically like a trading desk of finance dudes at the office? It's like you got the engineering, you got like the electrical, the installer guys, and then you got like these like quant finance bros who are like just the masters of the trading market.
Yeah, I would say like this is something we need to and are starting to get good at. I think there's like a sort of maybe movie theaters version of this which we don't want to have, and then there's the more real version, which is we're taking a data science based approach as opposed to a sort of trader. When you think of a person doing trades, it's like sort of what you see in the movies. It's not bad. It's a very scientific approach to how you're able to best monetize the value of the batteries, but also extremely importantly, how you're able to make sure that you have sufficient margin in the system for errors or issues, for backups, for outages, and how you're safely operating the system. And so we don't want to build a sort of trading desk and just set them loose to sort of like trade energy in the batteries. It's very much a co-optimization problem with a number of different sort of targets that you're trying to hit.
Totally. I mean, I imagine some of those constraints are really interesting. Like my gut instinct, like as soon as I heard about this idea, I was like, well, if I was a consumer, I would want to make sure that there was some sort of protection I had that like you are just going to like sell all my battery electricity away right before some outage or something. Like, oh yeah, prices are really high. So like we're just getting rid of all of the electricity that I want to use because it's at my house. Like I'm curious, like, do you have, like, I'm sure there are a lot of safeguards that are like that to protect the customer that are like for regulatory reasons or whatever. Like, do you mind talking about some more of them?
So I think it's like, it's somewhat of a misnomer that the, that high prices translate to high likelihood of outages. So what you'll typically find actually is that the, when prices are high, it is because of a supply and demand problem. And when there are outages, it's typically because of a, infrastructure failure problem. Somebody drove into a pole next to your house, or a hurricane came through Houston and tore down some wires and stuff. And those two things aren't really that correlated. And so I'd say that like, the likelihood that those two things happen together is to start with low. Okay. So that's like point one. Point two is we have a reserve capacity in the battery that we set dynamically based on the likelihood of an outage during the upcoming window. So that's like another sort of safeguard item. And the third thing I would say is, when you do have a correlated high price before outage, scenario, the way those typically work is that the grid operator needs to sort of shed load. This is, by the way, a really bad day for ERCOT or for Texas Grid. This does not happen very often, but it has happened. Where they'll rotate outages basically, and so your individual outage is quite short. So the energy you need in the battery to sort of sustain through that outage is relatively low, and we have a really big battery, and so it's like much larger than you would otherwise normally have, with a smaller one. The last point, kind of the fourth point, is if you look sort of just throughout a given day or week or month, we on average have a high state of charge in the battery, so. The chance that, you know, somebody randomly drives into a pole near your house or something, that happens right at the end of a discharge is quite low. And even then, we still have energy reserve left in the battery. If it happens any other time, it's like likely either fully charged or almost fully charged.
Yeah.
And so it's like less of a it's something we spend a lot of time thinking about, but it's maybe less of a sort of commonplace thing than you might think.
Yeah, totally. I imagine there's part of it too, where these pieces of software, like the different layers or whatever you would call them, are interacting in interesting ways. Like I could imagine that having telemetry from tons of homes all over the place would give you pretty good data that you could use for like the orchestration piece of it. Like, I don't know, are there like temperature things that maybe you have some cool sensors or something that can like pick up temperature or usage or whatever. Like what are the sorts of telemetry that might help you with that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. Like the data that we're able to capture off of the system is very important. And it's not even just important for us to operate our system. It's actually very, very beneficial to and important to the grid operators as they think about how to build new infrastructure or maintain existing infrastructure. The standard in the market today is that utilities at best have 15-minute interval data. Right. Mm-hmm. So every 15 minutes, they knew how much energy you used in the last 15 minutes. And that like lags a few hours or whatever. But they don't have sort of sub 15 minute data oftentimes. And they oftentimes have a challenge sort of aggregating and presenting that data in a sort of, useful or unique way. There's a handful of companies actually that are working on this sort of using meter data challenge. But we have much, much tighter telemetry on our system. And our system both measures what the battery is doing from a charge and discharge perspective, as well as what the home is doing from a consumption perspective. And so that data is very valuable to allow us to size our system, to operate our system, but we're also able to share that with the utilities, which in sort of some early discussions has been very, very beneficial to us. Very beneficial to them to really fine tune what energy usage means in a given very short period of time. And how that affects stress on the system. At the end of the day, kind of taking a big step back here, what we're trying to do is fortify the grid with energy storage. And to do that, we're able to time shift energy. We want to have sort of very fine grain data around the time with which we're shifting energy and kind of how that plays throughout the system. And so that data is super, super valuable to us.
Cool. This is totally far afield from the software piece we were just talking about, but I'm curious about it because it reminded me of like, so there are lots of reasons why your battery might just be better service for people. There's the outage thing, obviously. There's like the software piece of it, which is just a better sort of like user experience, more transparency about pricing, that sort of thing. But the third one, which we haven't talked about, I don't actually know if this is true, so you'll have to correct me if it's not. But is there a way that the battery being DC actually helps in some ways? Like the fact that you would have basically like a DC rail into your house as opposed to like AC? Can people actually use that? Is that a thing?
It is not a thing today, or at least not much of a thing today. It's funny, actually. A lot of appliances, inclusive of your EV, are right. Consume energy in DC form. So anything with a, or most things with a, you know, DC-based motor, convert or rectify specifically the AC that is on the grid back down to DC. But what if you had a big DC source in your home? That's a pretty interesting item. There's not an infrastructure built for this today, and it's not. It's not necessarily something that we're spending a lot of our like current time on, but it is a very pretty interesting thing. You can take it all the way back to the sort of Edison days in the fight between sort of DC and AC. AC ultimately won from the grid perspective, but there's a lot of things that consume energy at the end, you know, motor or whatever in the form of DC, and so having a DC system in a home is a potentially interesting future.
Well, awesome. Perfect, man. I mean, can you, is there anywhere you want to send people? Like, at like places like, I don't know, your website, or can they sign up for electricity if they're in Texas?
Yeah, totally. So you can sign up right on our website. You kind of like put in your address there and it tells you if we're servicing your area now. If not, we put you on the wait list. Website is basepowercompany.com, BASE powercompany.com. We're based out here in Austin. So for anybody who's either in Austin or is looking to move to the great city of Austin, we're also recruiting top talent. So yeah, thanks a bunch, Christian. Super great to have this discussion with you.